Gospel according to St. Mark, the 5th chapter. When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered around him, and he was by the sea. Then one of the leaders of the synagogue, named Jairus, came, and when he saw him, fell at his feet and begged him repeatedly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." So Jesus went with him. And a large crowd followed him and pressed in on him. Now there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. She had endured much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and she was no better, but rather grew worse. She had heard about Jesus, and came up behind him in the crowd, and touched his cloak, for she said, "If I but touch his clothes, I will be made well." Immediately, her hemorrhage stopped, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her disease. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus turned about in the crowd and said, "Touched my clothes." And his disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing in on you. How can you say, 'Who touched me?'" He looked all around to see who had done it. But the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came in fear and trembling, fell down before him and told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease." While he was still speaking, some people came from the leader's house to say, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" But overhearing what they said, Jesus said to the leader of the synagogue, "Do not fear, only believe." He allowed no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they came to the house of the leader of the synagogue, he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. When he had entered, he said to them, "Why do you make a commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed at him. Then he put them all outside and took the child's father and mother and those who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, get up." And immediately the girl got up and began to walk about. She was 12 years of age. At this, they were overcome with amazement. He strictly ordered them that no one should know this, and he told them to give her something to eat. The Gospel of the Lord. I want to ask you to consider the possibility that most people have a desire to stand out from others. And this gets expressed in so many ways, from the slogans that people hold on to the way they live their lives. Recently, in some research done out of Harvard, Nelia Ordabeva did some research to determine whether those who were conservative and those who were liberal were different in how they purchased items, if they were different as consumers. And in the research, she found out is that conservatives tend to differentiate themselves through products that show that they are better than others. So, for example, by choosing products from high-status luxury brands. In contrast, the liberals tended to differentiate themselves through products that show that they are unique from others. So, for example, by choosing products with unconventional designs or colors. Maybe like when a senior pastor needs to wear a bow tie to stand out from the rest of the colleagues who wear those black shirts all the time. But with conservatives, she draws a conclusion that when they shop, the need is to be superior to others. For progressives, when they shop, the need is to be more unique than others. I'm wondering whether those needs have an influence on how conservatives and progressives view their government. I want to take a look at that. I think that conservatives, when they bring their attraction to superiority to their understanding of country, come at understanding their country in a specific way. Listen to the stories they love to tell about their country. The stories of how George Washington was able to take that silver dollar and fling it across the river from one side to the other. The story of George Washington who couldn't tell a lie, and even though he cut down his mother's cherry tree, he confessed that he had done it. He was honest. They tell those stories of how people stand superior over others. They love the story of the self-made man who worked hard and pulled himself up by the bootstraps and made everything work for him. They love the concept of hard work and discipline being at the root of someone's success. Now, anytime they need a corrective in what's happening in the country, their corrective is focused externally. It's articulated, they should do this differently. They should be this way. They should act in this certain way. It's put outside of them. As anxiety and fear increases, I think this desire for superiority can lead to something that I call nationalism. Nationalism is characterized in a number of ways. Nationalism is characterized by the need to militarize the borders of the nation. Nationalism is characterized by the need to strengthen the armed forces in every way. This nationalism is characterized by a rejection of diversity, wanting things to be similar. Unity in nationalism is found in identifying the nation with a certain race. Unity is found in economics, where justice is determined by wealth. Unity is expressed in politics so that those who have the power are the ones that keep the power. Nationalism is characterized by the need to isolate a person's country from other countries. At its extreme, nationalism expresses their superiority by a call for purity. There's only one group that is to have the freedoms, to have the prestige, to have the power. And anyone who doesn't fit into that code of purity is then seen as an outsider. The conservative approach to shopping of superiority, I think, does play out in their understanding of nation as well as they tell their story through their need for superiority. Progressives, they bring their attraction to uniqueness to their understanding of country. The stories they tell are different than the conservatives. They love to tell the stories of when people came together for a good cause. They love to tell the stories of how, because when people worked together, amazing and good things happened. They love to lift up the notion that if we all work out to help one another, we can be at our best. That generosity is captured in self-sacrifice. And with the progressives and their need for uniqueness, anytime a correction is needed in a nation, the correction is focused internally. We should do this. We should have this. We should be this way. It's an internal focus for correction. As anxiety and fear increases, this uniqueness leads to socialism. It's characterized by this fusion with one another to the point where we can't tell where one person stops and the other person starts. It's characterized in strength expressed through emotionalism, that we're moved by emotion in order to act. It's characterized as unity found in pity for someone else. It's characterized in the mission of rejecting and attacking people instead of following and paying attention to the issues. At its extreme, this uniqueness that can be called socialism can lead to what author Robert Lupton calls toxic charity. The subtitle of the book is How Churches and Charities Can Actually Hurt the People They Are Helping. See, sometimes those who help because they have a need to help, and they need people to be weak so that they can help them. And in the process, they do things to continue to keep the person weak so that they are needed and continue to be offered themselves as the solution. My contention that neither approach to understanding nation is an approach that will bring benefit to the nation. Both desire to control the nation and to put their values upon the nation, but both of them are limited stories that don't enhance the worth and the dignity of the nation. You take a look at the book of Corinthians, what you will find in 1 Corinthians is the story of a church that's a disaster. It's the kind of church that as soon as you heard about it, you would never, ever even consider worshiping there. This is a church where when people disagreed with one another, they would settle their disputes by going to the courts and adjudicating it through the court system instead of working it out one person with one person. This is a church that those who are wealthier and didn't have to work the whole day would show up at the house church. They would eat all the food, and those who were poor and had to work long hours, well, they ended up having to instead have nothing to eat when they got back to the home church. This is the kind of church where those who could speak in tongues and interpret tongues insisted that they were superior to those who couldn't do that, that their spiritual gifts were greater than someone else's. This is the kind of church that a son-in-law is now having a relationship with his mother-in-law, and we'll just leave it at that. It's not the kind of church to which you want to belong. It's a broken community of people. But what is fascinating is next to this description of this broken, disastrous community, Paul puts in front of them qualities of love, love that is patient and kind and never envious or boastful or rude. It doesn't rejoice when someone else is wrong, but it builds up the community. And so we have juxtaposed with each other the way people are and the way people could be. The problem is there is no way for a person to move from the old to the new by their own will and their own strength. You see, we are all stuck in interpreting life in one particular way that serves our purposes but can be disastrous to anyone else. So how does one move then from this old way of being to a new way of being? Paul establishes this in 1 Corinthians. The way a person is moved from old to new is by death and new life. It happens in the cross of Jesus Christ, that as we die to the old self, we rise to the new self. As Christ was buried, we too are buried. As Christ was raised from the dead, we too are raised from the dead. It is God, through the cross of Jesus Christ, that moves us into a new being, that moves us away from this kind of living where we need to use other people to feel better about ourselves, into a way of being that's captured by patience and kindness and rejoicing in the gifts of human community. God's people, they live under a different story than the story of conservatism that defines the country. God's people, they live under the story of cross and resurrection, not under the story of progressivism and the need for uniqueness. The cross determines the story by which God's people live. And so when Paul then follows up with another letter in what we call 2 Corinthians, he talks about this excellent way that they now are living that excels what they're capable of doing simply as human beings. And this excellent way he shows in the text for today is the capacity for people to live in mutuality with one another. To be eager and generous with one another. That's the story that shapes who we are. Stanley Hauerwas, in his article, A Story Formed Community, writes that the church does not exist to provide an ethos over a democracy, but the church is an alternative to every nation. Witnessing to the kind of social life that is possible by those who are shaped by the story of the cross. A new way of engaging and living with one another. In this new way of being, it first of all gives us the capacity for imagination. It is Niebuhr who wrote that only when we know what has happened and what is going on do we then know what to do next. The need to understand what is happening, to make decisions about the future. I think that's a fascinating concept, to apply our imaginations to the problems our nation faces with regards to race. Are you aware that within our congregation, we have African American members who lived the first 20 to 25 years of their life without the same freedoms we have? Born prior to civil rights, they're members of our congregation for the first part of their lives, didn't enjoy the freedom that we as whites do. And once you understand what has happened and what is going on, you can then start thinking about how then do we speak to that as we look to our relationships now and to the future. Use your God-given imagination of mutuality to shape how you deal with people of other races. Likewise, when our story is shaped by the cross, trust becomes possible. Hauerwas says that any time we meet a new person, we face both the possibilities that person brings to the relationship and we face the threats that person brings to a new relationship. Trust is the capacity to engage with that person even though we feel we are also threatened by that person. Imagine what would happen if trust shaped our understanding of immigration over and against the need to maintain the purity of our country. See both the capacity and the challenge in living with someone from another race. And finally, as people who are shaped by the story of the cross, they're also then people who are shaped to hear and to tell the truth. And the truth is that for every person, there is good to that person and there is brokenness in that person. No person is all one thing or another. We can apply that to what's happened in the city earlier this week when a man was tased by a police officer. First of all, trust there's a process in place to determine what is going on, but not to make people either all one thing or all the other. Not to make police officers are always right all the time or police officers are wrong all the time in everything that they do, but to realize for each of us, we are made up of both what is good, but also that which is broken. The reality in which I live, as I think about police officers, it was about 2 years ago when my son was at a public park and someone was having a medical emergency. My son did the right thing and he called 911. A police officer arrived before the EMS squad. The first thing they did was put my son in the back seat of the cruiser and ask him what drugs he had given the person that made them sick. Biracial young man was assumed to be a certain way because of his race. Yet at the same time, the police officers in our congregation have asked for my cell phone number, and they have put that in their personnel files because if something happens to them, they want me to be called first so I can be with their wives, break the news to what happened to them. That's how we live with one another. All that is good and all that is broken. And when we live lives shaped by the story of the cross, it is exactly that. So I leave you with this. Think about faithfulness and think about loyalty. Faithfulness is your relationship with God. To be faithful to God in all times and in all places. Loyalty is your relationship to country. And certainly there's a lot to which we want to be loyal that is good about our nation. But if you get to the point where you have to choose between loyalty to nation and faithfulness to God, choose faithfulness to God. Because in God, one finds life. Amen.